could be sweeter than a sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Growing Up with Chapel Hill, The Village from 1901 to 1925, by Jane Toy Coolidge. Continuing in Chapter 3. Diagonally across the street from our house lived Miss Harriet and Miss Catherine Cole and their nephew, Mr. Jim Taylor. During the war between the states, the sisters had come as refugees from their plantation in the Deep South, and when they and other members of their large family needed servants, Miss Hattie, then a young woman, had made the trip south and brought back a carload of their slaves. Though I'm sure she did not call them slaves, they were referred to as our people. From what I knew of her as an old lady, I can see her doing it, for she was a strong character, bristling with administrative ability. A dumpy little woman, she looked like Queen Victoria, her hair screwed into a tight knot on the back of her neck, always wearing a black dress with a tight waist and a full skirt. She practically ran the local Methodist church, and it was said that every unmarried Methodist minister in the state had proposed to her. When she became convinced of the sanitary advantages of individual communion cups, she ordered a large supply of these, and had them installed forthwith, a giant step and radical departure in those days. Miss Catty Cole was older than her sister, tall, gaunt, and, to childish eyes, a grim and forbidding figure. She had very little hair, and what there was of it was covered by a flat cap. She gave me peppermint drops from her pocket when my mother brought me with her for an afternoon call, so there must have been a softer side to her nature than was apparent. Years later, Dr. Will McNider, who attended the sisters when they were ill, said that their nephew, Mr. Jim Taylor, put a supply of cigarettes in the drawer of the hat rack in the front hall once every week, and that Miss Catty collected these regularly and chewed them. I hope she did have this small pleasure, for it seems little enough in what must have been a pretty barren existence. Miss Hattie ran the household like a major general, supervising the cook, the maid of all work, and the yard man, Jim Jenkins. He was always called by his full name to distinguish him from Mr. Jim Taylor. He cared for the big front yard with its circular graveled walk raked in fishbone pattern, the prolific garden in back, the barn, the cow, and the chickens. He must have had helpers, for all these were meticulously kept, and Miss Hattie shared their abundant products generously. A frequent event at our house was the appearance of Jim Jenkins at the back door carrying a tray covered by a white napkin. Under the napkin would be a big bowl of syllabub or Bavarian cream, luscious strawberries or peaches, wine jelly, and maybe an added platter of rich sugar cookies called jumbles. Miss Hattie had strong views about the drinking of spirituous liquor, but its use in cooking was another matter, and the delicious syllabub she sent over was liberally spiked with wine or brandy or good bourbon. Whichever it was, the result was memorable. When many years later Miss Hattie broke up housekeeping and moved away, there was in her wine closet a sizable collection of rare and precious liquors. I can imagine the look of horror on my mother's face when she told my father that Miss Hattie had ordered Jim Jenkins to pour them all out on the ground, and watched him while he did it. She was a very old lady by this time. Miss Catty had died, and Miss Hattie herself had been through a severe case of pneumonia. Young Dr. McNider, just starting practice and filled with modern ideas, visited her sick room, opened the windows wide, and directed the nurse to leave them so. Miss Hattie waited till he had left, then sent for Jim Jenkins. "Jim," she commanded hoarsely, but with authority not to be denied, "get your hammer and the longest nails you can find. Nail those windows shut." He obeyed, and Miss Hattie survived.
M-A-T-R-I-M-O-N-Y. That's a high tone name for trouble. You'll pronounce it with a sigh. What causes all the misery in this land? If you want to find out, ask any married man. And he'll say M-A-T-R-I-M-O-N-Y.
When Mr. and Mrs. Toy came back to Chapel Hill in late August 1898 after their honeymoon in Canada, the village was drowsing in the heat of the southern summer. Eager to embark on her housewifely career, Jenny Toy began to lay in supplies. Mr. H.H. Patterson's large and well-kept grocery store provided staple foods, but little meat was to be had. Lack of refrigeration made local slaughtering risky, and the demands of the village were too small to attract shipments from outside. Poultry was the mainstay of the table from May to November, and Walter Toy had eaten so much chicken through the years that for the rest of his life he couldn't face a fowl without shuddering. On this first Saturday morning in her new home, Jenny was confronted by the problem of Sunday dinner. "People from the country bring in things to sell on Saturdays," her husband told her. "Butter and eggs, vegetables, fruit and meat when there is any. They drive right by here on their way into town. Maybe they'll stop for you." So Jenny went down the front walk and sat on the rock wall that separated the yard from the street. She hadn't waited long before a wagon stirred up the dust in the road. She stood, waved her hand, and called out, "Butter and eggs? Fresh garden stuff? Can you sell me some?" The driver pulled to a stop. She was a small, neat woman with direct, honest eyes that looked the stranger over from head to foot. The two boys who were with her in the wagon joined in the scrutiny. "Yes, ma'am," she called back. "Yes, ma'am, that I can." Never were truer words spoken. "The speaker sold my mother these things and countless others, not only on that August morning, but for the next 40 years. And in the process, she became a lifelong friend." Mrs. Whittaker lived on a small farm some miles west of Chapel Hill. She was considerably younger than her husband, who had fought under General Lee and, after Appomattox, walked home, carrying everything he owned in a ragged knapsack. Somehow he scratched a living from the rocky soil, and after years of labor brought his young bride to the home he had made ready for her. It wasn't an easy life, but Mrs. Whittaker was a worker. She helped her husband inside the house and out, and bore him sons, and kept the family to high standards of conduct and industry. When a woman on a nearby farm died in childbirth, Mrs. Whittaker brought the baby girl home with her from the funeral and cared for her as if she were her own. I wish I could say that the generous deed was well rewarded, but things didn't work out that way. The child inherited mental weakness which grew worse with the years, causing her foster mother many heartaches. On one of the rare occasions when the Whittakers invited our family to spend the day with them at the farm, the girl, Rosa, now a grown woman, hid all the good knives and forks and spoons, and refused to give them up. Mrs. Whittaker set the table with kitchenware, held her head high, and made neither explanation nor apology. But long afterwards she told my mother about it, and said that during the meal she had almost broken down and cried. Rosa had to be sent to the asylum. Mr. Whittaker died. The boys grew up and left the farm. Mrs. Whittaker spent her last years with them and their families in town, working till the end on quilts and coverlets, some of which were to keep my children warm. Her granddaughter, Mrs. Lelia Tilly, welcomes me when I come to Chapel Hill. Her kindness, her good sense, and the straightforward honesty that shines from her eyes never fail to remind me of the staunch little lady who was my mother's friend. The village had its share of eccentric characters, people who contributed a welcome bit of spice to the daily fare. Mr. Thee Best, Thee is for Theodore, who ran the telegraph office, was one of these. Late in life he bought one of the newly invented motorcycles, mounted it gaily, and roared up and down Franklin Street to the amazed admiration of assembled spectators. On he went, waving his hat in answer to the shouts of applause that followed him. Then, as the thrill of triumph subsided, the realization came to him that all he had thought of beforehand was the process of getting the machine started. He had no idea how to stop it. Shouts to friends on the sidewalk may have supplied the needed information, or he may have had to keep going till the gasoline gave out. The end of the adventure is shrouded in mystery. Miss Laura Ward had the appearance and some of the traits of a New England spinster. She was spare, neat as a pin, plain-spoken, and rigidly righteous. For years she took in sewing. Then she became head clerk in Mr. Andrews' dry goods store, where she ruled with a rod of iron. The telegraph office was near the store, on the second floor of a neighboring building. Mr. Thee Best and Miss Laura had known each other all their lives, and now they were thrown together when he came in to buy suspenders or shoelaces. It must have occurred to him that here was a fine, able woman, and that he was getting along in years. There were rumors that he was courting Miss Laura, and the town was agog with speculation as to a coming match. There was a new brightness in Miss Laura's eyes, a touch of pink in her cheeks, a spring in her step. But it would seem that in the end, stern common sense prevailed. Miss Laura continued to measure ginghams and percales and laces, while Mr. Best tapped out messages upstairs. Further down the street, Klutz's store could be counted on to supply just about anything you needed in a hurry. Candy, shoestrings, tobacco, magazines, matches, tablets, pencils, sardines, schoolbooks, soap, socks, shirts, Christmas cards, umbrellas, and patent medicines. These were all jumbled together in the dimly lit store across the street from the old post office. Dr. A. A. Klutz, the doctor was a courtesy title, the A. A. stood for Adam Alexander, was a kindly, genial soul, slow of movement and speech, who preferred sitting in placid conversation with his friends in the back of the store to standing behind the counter in front. It was reported that when one of these friends interrupted their talk to point to a customer waiting up front, Dr. Klutz whispered, "Shh, don't make any noise. Maybe he'll go away." He cared about people, not money, and maybe this preference caused Mrs. Klutz to open their home as a boarding house. This she did, and, being a woman of character and ability, created an outstanding establishment. It was like a small select club whose members enjoyed choice food, solid comfort, and good companionship. Mrs. Klutz, an imposing white pompadoured dowager, presided like a queen over the assembled guests. When I was married, she gave me a silver dinner bell and a piece of advice. When you wash your coffee pot, never put the top back on it. Leave the pot open so it will dry out every time, and you'll always have good coffee. Boarding houses were an important part of Chapel Hill life, filling the needs of bachelors and other unattached persons, and affording a means of support for ladies who had to earn a living. Running a house and making people comfortable was the one skill most women possessed. Some, like Mrs. Klutz, Mrs. Archer, and later Mrs. Bain, raised this occupation to the status of a high art, so that their homes became famous gathering places for congenial people where, incidentally, love affairs flourished and marriages were made. Other ladies went into the business on a larger scale, feeding students en masse. For this, a sizable house and large staff of servants were necessary, with a dining room big enough to seat hordes of hungry boys, with special tables for professors and other guests. Mrs. Julia Graves, widow of a professor and great-granddaughter of the university's first president, and of a signer of the Declaration of Independence, ran such an establishment in her home on the site of the present Carolina Inn. She maintained it for some years around the turn of the century, educating three sons and a daughter, all of whom distinguished themselves in their chosen fields of journalism, the army, and the arts. While doing this, Mrs. Graves won the affection and respect of all who shared her hospitality, including two generations of Chapel Hill children who knew her as Aunt Jewel. Mrs. Archer eventually maintained a similar establishment, and countless other women ran boarding houses on a smaller scale. It was customary, too, for faculty wives to rent spare rooms to young professors, students, and members of the college staff. Professors' salaries were small, and the extra dollars this brought in were more than welcome. My mother did this as the years went by, putting to good use the big house on West Franklin Street and making friends who were like members of her family.
Is there still room for me in the old apple tree?
wasn't long, and you know it wasn't strong, when I sat there with you. I've got fare back to Maine, and there's a foreign train, if your heart beats as fond and as true, is there still room for me?
Chapter 4. Dear Hearts and Gentle People. The people who live in a town make the town what it is, determining by their characters and actions the character of the place. They influence, for better or for worse, the lives of the men, women, and children whose daily paths cross their own. Throughout the history of the village, Chapel Hill has had many strong characters, people who have put their stamp on the lives of their fellow townsmen. Kemp Plummer Battle was a part of Chapel Hill from 1845, when he came to the university as a freshman, until he died here in 1919. During those 74 years as a student, tutor, trustee, president, and historian of the university, and as an active citizen and friend of everybody in town, he contributed unceasingly to the community. A child born in 1901 could know Dr. Battle only as an old gentleman, but there is evidence of his outstanding personality in the fact that he made a lasting impression on a shy little girl. I remember him as a slight figure, not tall but quite erect, with mutton-chop whiskers and a short gray beard. He had keen, kind blue eyes behind steel-rimmed spectacles. Active in mind and body, he was a great walker and talker, interested in everything and everybody. In those years, his wife was an invalid, and Dr. Battle cheerfully took over the responsibility for extending a courteous welcome to out-of-town guests who, according to the custom of the day, came to make long visits in faculty homes. One such guest was an aunt of mine, and when she was with us, Dr. Battle would call formally and invite her to go for an afternoon walk in the woods that surrounded the town. Such walks were his favorite diversion, and he was eager to share this pleasure with others. Promptly, at the appointed hour, he would appear at the front door, and my aunt, pleased and flattered by the attention of this distinguished ex-president of the university, would join him for what would now be called a nature walk. I hope her shoes were comfortable. She was not a nature lover, and walks were not her favorite occupation, but masculine company was, and such charming company as Dr. Battle's was a privilege at any time. It would be interesting to know how many miles he covered on such excursions. His home, Senlac, was a long mile from our house on West Franklin Street, so he walked 2 miles to call for the lady and escort her back. Then, if he chose to show her the paths he was having cleared in the woods southeast of the campus, Battle Park, but to us then, Battle's Park, there were several more miles in addition. He was insatiably interested in plants of all kinds, wildflowers, ferns and trees, in the geologic formation of the terrain and the animals inhabiting it, so there was always plenty to talk about, and if my aunt grew tired, they could sit down for a while on a fallen log or a big rock beside the path. If Piney Prospect was the day's objective, there were resting places here with a view of the wide plain that had been the bed of a Triassic sea. Another goal might have been the abandoned iron mine in the woods north of the village. There were no new paths through the woods here, but an old wagon trail was still usable, though rough and overgrown. The open mine shaft was a relic of an abortive attempt to obtain iron ore, possibly during the Civil War, when the need for it was great. Dr. Battle had had a special part in supplying this need, having served as president of the Chatham Railroad Company, which was built to haul coal from Chatham County for the use of Confederate munitions factories. This coal was of poor quality and too scanty to make the project a success, but at the time it seemed to offer an answer to major need. It was one of the doomed efforts of the lost cause. Like a good many other North Carolinians, Kemp Battle was a Union man by conviction, but when Lincoln called out the troops to force the seceding states into submission, he supported the Southern cause, saying, "It is better to go out together, even if we are whipped back together." As a delegate to the state convention in May 1861, he voted for secession, and then tried to enlist in the Confederate Army. Instead, he was made responsible for building the railroad that was to bring coal and iron from Deep River in Chatham County to supply munitions factories. He served in this and other administrative positions for the 4 years of the war. So the old iron mine in the woods near Chapel Hill must have held poignant associations for him when he peered down the crumbling shaft, tossed in a pebble, and waited to hear it splash in the water at the bottom. When the war had dragged to its end, Dr. Battle practiced law in Raleigh, working for the reopening of the university, and in 1876 was called by the trustees to be its president. He served in this post for 15 years, contributing clear vision implemented by sound educational standards, good practical sense, and skill in getting people to work together. The last-named quality was very important in those days of violently conflicting opinions. In the early 1900s, Dr. Battle was an ever-present part of the Chapel Hill scene, a slight figure in a long coat with a shoulder cape, a black derby, carrying a stout cane. He was always ready to talk, knew everybody and their aunts, uncles, cousins, cooks, and handymen, and was more than apt to have an amusing anecdote about every one of them. When I was in the 9th grade, our teacher started a new, hitherto undreamed-of project, a class paper. I was given an assignment, Legends of Chapel Hill, and told to write on the subject. Chapel Hill legends? Were there any? If so, I'd never heard of them. Go to see Dr. Battle, the teacher said. He'll tell you. I was caught in a trap. There was no way out but to follow instructions. This I did, scared stiff and shivering with shyness. Somehow, probably with my parents' help, an interview was arranged. Dr. Battle received me as if I were a grown lady and a fellow antiquarian. Chapel Hill legends? Yes, there are some. Do you know about Peter Dromgoole? Did you ever see the big rock with the blood stain on it? Suppose we walk out there and take a look. So out we went to the huge, low, rounded stone in Battle's Park, and he told me about the young man who had fought a duel with a fellow student, over a lady love, I think, and killed him. Dr. Battle pointed out the dark stains on the rock, said to be the victim's blood. Then, since we were so near Piney Prospect, we went on to look out over the wide plain to see smoke rising from smokestacks in Durham. Carefully conscientious in my role of embryo reporter, I took notes as to Dromgoole and the other things we talked about. I wish I could remember these things now, but, alas, they've vanished from my mind, and, as far as I know, no copy remains of that early journalistic effort. The next year I went away to boarding school at St. Mary's in Raleigh. What was my surprise one afternoon to be summoned to the parlor to receive a gentleman caller? None other than Dr. Battle. Quite an old gentleman now. He was to die in 1919 at the age of 88. He was the same familiar figure in the coat with the shoulder cape, a little stooped now, his cane held firmly in both hands clasped before him. The same kind, gently courteous manner, the same friendly concern for a shy little girl. That he, full of years and honor, a busy man even at that advanced age, his keen mind occupied with important things, took time during a visit to his old home in Raleigh to make this call, was abundant evidence of a great and generous heart. There never beat a heart more full of love for Chapel Hill, and never was there a spirit more active in fostering the highest interests of the community.
Let's take an old-fashioned walk.
Let's have an old-fashioned call.
We will walk any place you choose to.
But let's talk about the things we used to.
If you want a novelty in outdoor pastime, something for the real blasé, it's an old-fashioned walk.
And an old-fashioned talk
with an old-fashioned girl someday.
It's our town's good fortune to have inspired such love in the hearts of many people. Some have come by accident or choice, attracted by Chapel Hill's reputation as a pleasant place to live, and have stayed to fall under the spell of the charm that lingers on our shaded streets, despite the growing pains that have afflicted us in recent years. But the people who came to live here in the early 1900s were moved by no such frivolous notions. Their purpose in coming was strictly utilitarian. They had to make a living. A good many of the newcomers were women. One of these was Mrs. Archer. She arrived with her husband and a family of growing children, settled down, and ran a boarding house for 15 or 20 years. This was located at first on the site of the present Carolina Inn, where Mrs. Julia Graves had run a similar establishment. Later, Mrs. Archer built a large house halfway down the block on Columbia Street, near the subsequent location of the Ackland Museum. Here she had rooms for a selected group of teachers and other young people who were like members of a club. The huge dining room, with a separate entrance, she supplied meals to large numbers of students. These combined operations required administrative ability of a high order, and this Mrs. Archer had in good measure. She was a short woman, 60-ish as I remember her, her dark hair drawn into a tight bun, her plain dress, or white shirtwaist and dark skirt, immaculately neat, her expression composed and confident. She ran the house with a firm hand, making a good living, educating her children, and ensuring a comfortable old age. Mr. Archer was an adjunct, a gray-haired, whiskery old gentleman who presented something of a problem. He got in the boarders' way, examined their mail, and made shocking remarks. People were kind to him because of their respect for his wife, and she had long ago accepted him, for better or worse. What was the history of their early life together? It is a closed book now, but I think Mr. Archer may well have been a casualty of the war between the states. Not physical wounds, but psychological ones could have taken their toll of him, as was the case with many of the young men who grew up during and after the war. The structure of their world had been demolished. They were like castaways on a desert island, with no training for survival and scanty means with which to survive. Some summoned strength to meet the need, adapted themselves to their changed world, and survived. Some, indeed, prospered, and grew all the stronger for the challenge. But others fell by the wayside, a truly lost generation, and it seems to me that Mr. Archer was one of these. Mrs. Archer was of the surviving kind. As to the steps that led the family to Chapel Hill, I know nothing, but the facts are clear. Two young people fall in love and marry during the poverty-stricken days of Reconstruction. The husband's attempts to support a growing family fail. Repeated failure reduces him to embittered despondency. The wife takes the reins and builds a successful career. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.